Went to officers
Academy
school.
Camp Davis, North Carolina.
Camp Davis.
Yes. Anti-aircraft artillery.
And then?
And I graduated there as a second lieutenant. And it must have been around the time of the Battle of the Bulge. And they were in, they had a shortage of infantry officers. So upon graduation, they sent me to Fort Benning, Georgia, and made it what they call a retread out of me, converted me from an anti-aircraft artillery officer to an infantry officer. And after I became an infantry officer, I was sent down to Camp Landing, Florida, where I became a training specialist, a platoon leader for taking raw recruits and in 17 weeks turning them into combat replacements.
Camp Landing, Florida.
Camp Landing. And our responsibility was to take these new recruits and in 17 weeks turn them into combat replacements.
In 17 weeks?
17 weeks. And it was quite a responsibility. And I might say that I was just a young fellow then. I was, I guess, 20 years old at the time. And I encountered my first experience with anti-Semitism.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, my captain, who I've been trying to find, and every time I go down to, he came from Spartansburg, he lived in Spartansburg, South Carolina, Clyde Dobson, and I've scoured, every time I go down south, I go through telephone directories trying to find him. He graduated from, I think, BMI, but he was a great fellow, southern boy, but the battalion commander, who had been a second lieutenant in World War I and kept a reserve commission, he was a lawyer in New York City. When World War II broke out, he came back in active duty, and now he was a major lieutenant colonel, and he was a real anti-Semite. Every Jewish officer was court-martialed. He found some reason. Major Sorensen, who was in charge of training, he found something he did wrong and court-martialed him. Lieutenant Weinstein, who was a superior officer, one of his sergeants during a training exercise pulled out a grenade and said, "This is a smoke grenade." And it turned out to be a white phosphorus, and he let it go, and a couple of recruits got blinded. Lieutenant Weinstein, who was miles and miles away, got blamed because it was his responsibility. He got court-martialed, that reduced him. Everybody. And this man, this Lieutenant Colonel Moore.
Got his name?
Yeah, I'm sure he's long dead by now. Threatened to court-martial me so many times for a number of things that he and I disagreed upon. For example, when we would come back from a 25-mile march, and these young fellows were, feet were bleeding, they were hurting, they were just making the transition. I was hardened, I was a pretty seasoned hardened in pretty good shape, and he would order me, he wouldn't go on the march. By the way, on the march, he would be hiding like the 18th and 19th mile, and all of a sudden he'd honk his horn in cadence and make me give my men in cadence on the march, you know. And when I came back to the camp after the 25-mile march, he ordered me to give my men a close order drill. Now, you know, these guys are dragging, they can hardly walk, and I have to put my men through close order drill. And a number of times I disobeyed him. and he threatened to court-martial me in public. I mean, we had a hurricane. We were just talking about it the other day. We were at lunch with one of my friends, talking about hurricanes. You ever been in a hurricane? I was down, we were in bivouac down in Florida, and dug in, and a hurricane came in. And when you're in foxholes and you got a hurricane, that water fills up those holes pretty fast. So I ordered my men outside the foxholes. Well, during the lull, he was living in a trailer. During the lull, it was the eye of the hurricane, or whatever, he'd come out and see my men laying on top of the ground, and he'd chew me out and say, "Get your men back in those waters." And I had to direct my men to go jump back in the water in these foxholes, and then he would get out of the, go back to his tent, and I'd say, get out there, and he and I had this running battle, you know. And anyway, I got to the point where I just couldn't take it anymore. He threatened to court-martial me in public a number of times. The worst thing you can do is reprimand somebody in front of all your men. You know, you never do that. And I finally decided I had enough. And I look back on those days and don't know how I had the intestinal fortitude to do it, but I checked in one night to his quarters, and he said, at ease. I leaned over on his desk, and I said, "Colonel, you have threatened to court-martial me so many times, you go ahead and do it. Because I'm going to counter-court-martial you with charges. I know that the regimental commander doesn't like senior officers to entertain women in their quarters after hours, and particularly married officers. And I have three or four officers that are prepared to testify that you've been doing that." Well, he got apoplectic. And 2 days later, I'm out in bivouac. I come to chief with my orders for overseas. So it's one way to go. So anyway, I went through a couple of cycles of that, and then I went overseas and sent over to the Italian campaign. And
when was that, Lord?
This had to be probably in the fall of 45. And then while I was over there, I ended up in a battalion field hospital, and then in Naples. I was in a general hospital, and I was sent back.
What happened?
Well, I was the Germans were pretty ferocious fighters, and they were dug in on all the abbeys and on top of the hills. And I was running around with a bunch of troops trying to, you know, every time we hear a report that there was a Germans were breaking through, we'd take our men and we'd go different places, you know. And I ended up, it was rain and winter, it started to get the winter of 45. And all of a sudden, I just fell over and collapsed, I guess, from weariness. They took me into the battalion aid station. They diagnosed me as having pneumonia and pleurisy and a few other things. And while I was there, my leg started to swell up and started to turn color. And they decided that I couldn't stay any longer at the field hospital. My time was up, and they sent me to the general hospital. And I was slated for upper thigh amputation.
What was the matter with your leg?
Well, they decided that I had blood clots and was so bad that they were afraid it was turning gangrenous. And they had scheduled me for surgery. And here you are, you're 21 years old, you're in a strange country, nobody's around, all your troops are gone, your parents are here, and they didn't even know where I was, you know. And fortunately, some colonel from Vanderbilt came in and from Vanderbilt University, and he saw me, and when he found out I read my case, he thought he could save my leg with some medical surgery. So he cut my belly open, and he tied off certain veins and arteries and stuff like that, and at that time that was considered to be radical surgery. And they sent me home on a hospital ship, When I came back to the States, I never told my parents. I had some nurses write some letters for me back home so I could maintain my contact. My parents never had any problem until I got back to the States. And then I called him and tried to calm him down. I was in the hospital. And of course, they rushed up to Boston to see me at the Army hospital there. And they told me that I probably would never walk well again. And I went through an extensive rehabilitation program with a number of places. One of the interesting places I went to was a vascular center called Ashford General Hospital.
ASHFORD.
It doesn't mean much to anybody except when I tell you that it's White Sulphur Springs, the Greenbrier, White Sulphur Springs. That's what it was. That was the Greenbrier, White Sulphur Springs, which is called Ashford General Hospital. And they used it for Japanese internees and also the vascular center. And I went through, when I first came home, well, you know, on my leave, I was on crutches for some time, and then I was on a cane, and until I was trying to develop get collateral circulation in my leg, because all the veins were tied off both of my legs, so try to develop that. And I think that's when I met my wife, when I was home on leave from Texas, I guess I was. Well, I know. They sent me back to full duty, back to Camp Hood, Texas, and I could not do full duty. I'm an infantry officer, you know, and tried to do all of the physical stuff that was required. I couldn't do it, so they finally put me into a hospital to determine what to do with me. And it was during one of those days that I came home and met my wife on a blind date. Except she was not my date. She was my friend's date and fixed me up with somebody else. And I said, I like your date better than mine. So he said, let's switch. So we switched, and that's how I met Harriet. Any event, I went back to Texas, and I was...
you met your wife?
Retired.
No, in Pittsburgh.
But I was retired from the service, and I am still considered a retired officer because of disability. And... when I came out of the service, I had a GI Bill, so I decided to go back to Pitt, and I got my master's. And at that time, Harry was a senior in school, so we started going together, and that's history in terms of what happened to us.
Did you get any kind of a medal for that
some commendations or something in my, you know, after I was in the Italian campaign. I am classified as a service-connected injury.
So your master's is in what field?
In business.
BA.
Yeah. And today, I have a distinction that where I have a my Army retired card, which still shows everybody that I'm still a member of the armed forces, and I can get all the military bases that I want to. So
you're a retired officer on disability.
Yes. Correct.
And then you got your master's degree.
Got my master's degree at Pitt. And
is that how you got involved?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I always thought I was going to go in business, and I thought that I had a business bent, you know, and it occurred to me, I was looking for a job, and of course, when I got married, Harry and I got married.
Excuse me, what was Harry's maiden name?
Rich, R-E-I-C-H. When I got married in August of 47, I did not have a job. But I graduated college in June. I got my master's in June of 47, and... we were job hunting, and the thought occurred to me that when I was in the Army hospitals going through rehabilitation, there was all of us, all banged up from the service, wondering what we're going to do with our lives. And what were we doing? We were hooking rugs, tooling leather, stenciling tablecloths, and the gray ladies from the Red Cross would come in and help us. And nobody talked to us about careers, vocations. And so when I came out of the service, it occurred to me that there was a need to help disabled people get to work. And I thought that my business education would serve as a good bridge between the business community who was looking for workers and the disabled community. So I began to look for what agencies were in the community. And I found this little agency down on Penn Avenue, which at that time was called the United Vocational and Employment Service.
United Vocational
and Employment Service, which was an agency that was a member of the Jewish Federation, although most of its funding came from the United, at that time was called the Community Chest. And it got some small allocation from what was at that time called the United Jewish Fund. In those days, it was before the merger, we had the Federation and the Fund. And it was, we were a Federation agency, but got no money from Federation. We got some money from the United Jewish Fund to help in the relocation of some of the immigrants who came to the city. But by and large, the agency was serving Jews who had problems and other disabled people who were referred from the Veterans Administration, from Catholic Charities, from Jewish and Family Show. They all had problem people. And I went for some interviews before I got married, and Harriet and I went on our honeymoon, and when we came back, we got an apartment, no telephone. In those days, you had to wait in line for a telephone. It was tough to get apartments in those days, in 1947. And we got a basement apartment on the General Forbes apartment on Forbes Avenue between Whiteman and Murray. And the day we got back on a honeymoon, we came back on a Sunday night for somebody's wedding. And Monday morning, somebody knocked on our door and wanted to know if we were the Weitzman. We said, yes. And she said, well, Mr. Weitzman, your mother's been trying to call you, and she's trying to get a hold of you. Would you call her? So I got dressed, and there was a Sundrug up the corner of Murray and Forbes. And I called my mother up, and she told me that the director of the agency had been trying to get in touch with me when I call him. So my next call was to him, and he says, I'd like to talk with you. When can you come down? I said, well, I can come down this afternoon. So he said, okay. I went down to see him for another interview. And after a while, he says, I want to hire you as a placement counselor. When can you start to work? I said, I'm not doing anything now. He said, there's your desk. And that afternoon, I went right to my desk and started to work. So my work date at that agency was exactly 15 days after my marriage date. In 2 weeks, I was away, and the first day I got back. So and that began my career at that agency.
Well, then, but you were very active in having a building built and changing the name of the agency.
Well, yes. What happened was that I started as a placement counselor there, and then we had a little workshop that wasn't doing very well, and the director and I talked about it, and he said to me, you've got some business acumen. You think you can do something with that operation? I said, I'd like to give it a try. He said, okay. Why don't you start working part-time in the workshop and see what you can do?
What were your other functions other than the workshop?
Huh?
When you were hired, what was the main activity of the organization?
Well, the main activity was providing counseling, vocational counseling to high school kids and adults, finding jobs for Jews and people with problems. And the workshop was to provide both employment and a work experience for some people. So that was all part, and some training. Those were the components of the agency. It's a very small agency. We had a staff of 7 people, I think the total budget was like $30,000. It was not a very big operation. Incidentally, when I started there in 1947, my salary was $2,100 a year. And there was a, since I was a disabled veteran, a man by the name of Maurice Snyder, who I had known from a long time ago, that he used to date my next door neighbors on Uri Drive, a sister. He was a counselor at the VA, working with disabled veterans. And he got me a supplement under Public Law 16, $35 a month or whatever it was, some small amount that was a big difference in those days in terms of my being able to make a living. And but as time went on, I began to. By the way, there's a story about Maurice Snyder that might be interesting later on, which I want to come back to. But I began to do well with the workshop until finally the director said, why don't you spend full time now at the workshop because you're getting to go pretty well. And I did. And then, that was 1947. In 1953, he took a job in Philadelphia, and the board selected me to be the director of the agency. That was 1953. And I, as time went on, I began to realize that the agency, since we got really no funds from the Jewish community except for direct services to Jewish immigrants, that and we were getting all our money from the community chest, it occurred to me that for the agency to really meet its mission, it had to become non-sectarian in its base. And so we initiated a study. I initiated a study with the Federation. And it was jointly agreed that it would be everybody's best interest if we became not a Federation agency, but a direct recipient from the United Fund, and that if the Federation would continue under contract, give us whatever money was necessary to meet whatever needs the Federation thought could be met by this agency.
What did National Council of Jewish Women have to do with your project?
You know, that's a good question. Somewhere in the archives, National Council of Jewish Women is mentioned. Now, before I got to this agency, back in the early days, and Jim, I think your father was involved to some degree, and some of the men that were interested in the community were trying to deal with the problems of Jews who could not work, and for a variety of reasons. Now, in those days, those early days, there was no such thing as public assistance. All the religious groups helped their own, so that if you were Jewish and you were unemployed, you got money. There was a lachamonium that used to collect money and give you food baskets. There was the Federation and other groups that collected money to help out Jews that were in financial distress. And these Jews, and I think there was some involvement of the National Council, who said, you know, Jews are always usually forward-thinking, and said it doesn't make sense just to keep giving out a dole to people. What we need to do is to get these people off the dole and into work. So let's start an agency that will do that. And that was the genesis of this agency.
The genesis of the agency of the
United Vocational.
Yeah, that was not the first name. The first name of that agency was called the United Business Service.
So the first name was United Business Service.
That's correct.
And this is pre-1947.
Oh, this was back in the 30s. Okay, back in the 30s.
And you think that's when council had something to do with this?
Yes.
But you didn't have anything to do with it.
I myself at that time did not know. But I understand. I see council written into the archives back there in terms of working with some of the Jewish leaders, Federation leaders primarily, because as I said, in those days, Federation was a separate entity from the United Jewish Fund, and the Jewish Fund worried was primarily the support of Israel, and the Federation dealt with local problems. So it was the Federation leaders, people like Louis Kaplan and Joe Silberstein, and, that were Hyman Rogal, and all these people that were all concerned in those days. And it was those men, along with some representation from the Council of Jewish Women, who were meeting to try to solve the problems of Jews who were in distress. So they got the idea. I think it started out initially as a committee of the Federation, and then it turned out to be the United Business Service. And when the Community Chest was formed in 1932, they got this agency in as a charter member of the Community Chest. So it was always direct support from the Community Chest.
I see.
And then,
so then when you became the director, you were just a direct recipient of the United Fund and had a stipend or whatever you had from Federation.
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, tell us about your time with the...
Well, when we went through the study... the name had changed a couple of times, United Business Service, and the reason that they had to give that name up, there was an organization in Boston who was an investment advisory service by that name. They found out about our name, and they said, you better change the name, so they changed it to United Employment Service. And then, and I think the word United came because of the United Jewish Fund. United seemed like United was a good name to have in those days. And it wasn't a United Fund in those days. It was Community Chest, so that name preceded the United Fund. And then it became United Employment Service, and then it was decided that they were doing more than employment. They were doing training and counseling, so United Vocational and Employment Service was adopted. And that was a name that was there when I joined in 1947. And then when we went through the study in the 50s and... In 1960, when the study was completed, it was decided that we would go independent and become a separate agency of the United Way. We changed the name to the Vocational Rehabilitation Center. That was in 1960.
In 1960?
Yes. When we were going through the study as the United Vocational and Employment Service, we were looking for a new name. And the question was whether or not the name United, which had been there from its origins, would remain in the name, United Rehabilitation or United something like that. But since there was a United Fund and the United Jewish Fund, two distinct agencies with the word United, and there was some thinking that having United as part of our name would be a little too conflicting with the other names. So when the committee that had the responsibility for getting a name, I think Milt Sussman was the chairman of that committee, it was decided that maybe it was best to drop that name, and we did. But not without a lot of protest the concern by a lot of people.
So tell us about the...
When we went through not only the name change, but the agency itself began to progress. We went through a series of physical moves from one location. I always say from one substandard location to another substandard location. Until finally, down on Penn Avenue, I was convinced that the only way the agency would ever get anywhere would to have a building that would be have a couple of things. Number one, I thought it had to be nice enough so that the people who came for service felt like they were treated with some dignity rather than the squalid quarters we're in. And secondly, I thought that it had to be centrally located, and so we went through some planning to see about our future building needs. And I happened to, in my search, found a lot up on Forbes Avenue that, and I remember as a youngster, since I lived in that area, down Logan Street area, that Rixby Junket Dairy used to be on that location on the corner of Stevenson and Forbes. And the dairy had been torn down, and the Urban Redevelopment Authority had purchased that land, and it was part of what they called the Bluff Street Project, which meant that it would have some relevance for Duquesne University. And but for some reason that I don't understand, Duquesne University decided not to cross Forbes Avenue. They wanted to stay on one side of the Forbes Avenue. Meanwhile, the URA had bought Rickford Junkin and all the stores on McGee Street, tore them all down, and the lot was leveled. And originally I was trying to get some land up around my original origins, up around the Civic Arena. There were some lots there, but the URA didn't want to give those up. They had some ideas of high-tech plants, and I might add, those lots are still empty. All those years, never did anything with them. But then when I found this land, and I found the whole city block, I decided that this was an ideal place. My own studies had shown that this was centrally located, it was near enough downtown, so that people could come up from downtown for meetings. It was central to all transportation, Fifth Avenue, Forbes Avenue. I had heard about the Crosstown Boulevard and the Civic Arena being built, and I knew that all the roads would converge that area. And I said, from an accessibility point of view, that'd be an ideal spot. So